It's now time to think outside the box of what we've always known.
I myself will tend my sheep and have them lie down, declares the sovereign Lord.
I think that's a profound turning point in somebody's relationship with God.
And our hope in starting this was that this would become an ever-expanding conversation.
Just two real guys talking about life. That's a nice tagline.
I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Brad Cummings.
And welcome to another edition of The God Journey.
Your mountains are gone.
I'm not so foggy today.
Your mountains are gone.
It's not that sunny Southern California day you expect, but I like
it
the clouds.
It lasted a week.
I like the clouds. Well, not quite. No.
Yes, it
didn't. No, it didn't.
Oh, it did.
No.
6 days.
It lasted more than 3 o'clock. I'll admit that. I said it lasted
until
3.
No, it lasted several days because we enjoyed it from my house.
It actually did.
It did. That was amazing. I was going like, wow. Now Washington's that, moving here.
Now it's got that low coastal fog stuff. This I love. I love this fog stuff and rolling
through
the valley.
You're kind of like a Cape Cottish sort of guy, huh?
I really am. I'm always into it.
I could see you in fisherman garb. That'd be cool.
Can we think in the fisherman garb?
No?
No. But
I could see you big yellow slicker, you know, with boots and on the deck of a boat.
And fishy scaly things all over me. And
no, I'm not sure you go there.
I'm not sure either.
I could see you. I don't know.
No, not me. No, okay. But I do. Any cloudy day is a great day, and any sunny day is just, and I know people in New England and Seattle are going, what?
I'm very different than you.
I grew up in the Central Valley of California. It had sun 385 days a year.
That's a frying pan.
So I am really much.
You're over it.
I'm any cloudy day is a good day. My wife doesn't like them.
You should live up in the drizzly Pacific Northwest.
Went out to Pomona this weekend.
Pomona.
There was a group of live stream God Journey critters that got together out there that didn't know each other and didn't, you know. So we thought, well, we'll go out there and hang out with them for the week. It was fun.
What did you do in Pomona?
We just had about 4 hours to come and open house, bring some goodies, and Sarah brought her chocolate chip cookies, which people tore into.
They become a favorite wherever.
There were six kids in the kitchen, ate them
There's
all.
There's a special
much, guess,
Jacobson but. Recipe for that, is there not?
A special, I don't know if the recipe is all that special, partly that. There's a Jacobson recipe, but it's the way Sarah mixes. It's one of those
very
things
unique.
Where it's,
yes, I understand. It's like, I don't know how someone would have ever figured this out.
It's not really the recipe because it's textures at certain part of the mixing.
It's
and
the handiwork of the chef.
And then pulling them out of the oven at exactly the right. Sarah has that down. There is a moment you pull them out where they say soft and chewy, but they're cooked. Leave them in 2 seconds longer, and they turn hard and brown and crunchy. And do them less, and they Sarah's got it down. I'm telling you, she's the gal. So people have been saying, these are the famous chocolate chip cookies. I'm going, I don't think I've even talked about them for a while. But if people think I have weight issues, that would be the reason. And it's not just a cookie dough. It's not just cookies. She puts cookie dough in the fridge, so
it
lives on way
it's
past baking
good.
Day. It is all good.
We were cooking pizzas for a whole slew of kids who we're all over at the house, stuff like that. And then we got called out by somebody, and we were talking for a while. Turned into cheese Frisbees.
Inside the house.
Yes. They were in there long enough that you're just going like, nobody's eating that. The best thing you can do is throw that in the backyard back and forth. So we missed that. Just that right window to bring it out when it's still chewy and it's still whatever. So
the pizza wasn't good. That was the problem. It was too hard? Is that the problem?
It was burnt beyond, beyond recognition.
Oh, boy.
That
so
was,
what
hey,
do we
that,
do? Order out?
Tuna fish and crackers.
Tuna fish and crackers. Now, I had a great comment, though, while we were out there with this group in Pomona. One lady was telling us about their departure from a more traditional congregational. The church had been through a huge fight, and the pastor, I guess, who was fairly well liked but kind of crossed some of the political lines he wasn't supposed to cross, got fired. And
that'll get you in.
They got some new guy in. And so this family got a 10-year-old daughter.
Yeah.
This is great. And so a couple weeks into this, they're still going. They're still partying. They love people, good friends there. And they were getting up one Sunday morning, and the 10-year-old comes up and says, are we going to church today? And mom says, I don't know, honey. What do you think? And here's how a 10-year-old responded. I don't think we should. It's stupid, and it's led by monkeys.
What? It's stupid. and it's led by monkeys. Explain. I don't get this.
That's a circumference.
It's just led by monkeys.
It's led by monkeys. I mean, I guess she'd had enough of the whole political thing, and the pastor was God, and heard her parents complain loud enough. And but I have been to places like this where it's stupid and it's run by monkeys. Now, before we get all the letters, not saying every Sunday morning congregation is stupid and run by monkeys. So that's not the comment at all. But occasionally you find that one that is.
I tell you, I was doing some filing, and I ran across that picture of Darth Vader again.
Oh, yeah. Find the procession of the Anglicans. Yeah. Hilarious.
I showed it to someone who'd never seen that, and they just were speechless for the first moment, like, then they just bust up laughing.
Oh, there's a video out there like that. You watch the whole procession. That's just unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Too funny.
I enjoyed, though. We watched a little bit of the Oscar thing. I don't know why. We didn't see any of the movies this year, so we're kind of really out of that. But we were flipping through it, and my brother used to be Jerry Lewis's director.
Uh-huh.
So I was really interested in catching that little achievement award thing they gave to him. And I love that little poem thing he used as part of his deal. You know, he did that thing, I expect to pass through this world but once. Any good, therefore, that I can do or any kindness I can show to any fellow creature, let me do it now. Let me not defer or neglect it, for I shall not pass this way again. And I love that little phrase. I mean, I've heard it before, and it's just kind of the magic of the moment. This day,
right.
This combination of circumstance, people, whoever you're with, even waiting in line at Home Depot, the person in front of you, whatever, there's just an opportunity to be kind and gracious, and you won't have this chance again. And I think it's a... As a new guilt-induced kind of performance thing, that's a lousy poem.
Okay, no.
But in terms of an invitation into grace, I think it's fabulous. And so I looked up on the internet. I'm going, oh, where did that come from? I'm not even sure where that came from. And it came from a Quaker missionary from France to the U.S. in the 1700s. Made that statement.
How cool is that?
I thought, what a grace. That's just grace.
Well, I mean, you can live life embracing those opportunities. And it is, it's an absolute adventure. It's a sense of wonder. I mean, I love that. Or you can go around just ruzzle fruzzle and miss it all.
Yeah.
And that's really a choice that we make. That's not some guilt-inducing. It's like, how do you want to approach this? I can't do anything about what just happened.
Yeah.
I really can't. But I can do something about what's in front of me. And I just don't want to get stuck.
When I read Romans 12 this morning in the message, there was so much of that language from Eugene Peterson about don't get sucked into the way the world thinks about things. And one of the things I was thinking about saying there was how difficult it is just to live in generosity in a world that's demanding equality. You know, if you get caught up in what's fair and what should I get and what's right vis-a-vis what you should get and what's right based on however you want to measure that stuff, and gosh, the business side of my life right now with loan meeting and all that, I get caught up in that stuff. I get caught up in, okay, we started out to live generously. And then when you watch how publishers and foreign rights people, I mean, some of the things that we've talked about.
That's not the starting point for
everyone. No one else wants to live in this generous space of, hey, let's all be good to each other. Let's find out what works. If you're unhappy, come talk. If I'm unhappy, let's talk.
Great to start there, and then we'll negotiate towards selfishness from there.
I can't do it. I'm just thinking, there's nothing about the business world that Romans 12 applies to.
I know. I'm still holding out thinking that maybe there's something that applies.
No, because even on the freeway, if you're going to live generously and some moron cuts you off, pushes, you know, you're coming around to park and he jumps in and parks in ahead of you. There is nothing about generosity that works in that space. If you even begin to think about equitability and punishment and pulling the gun out from under my seat and blasting a hole in that man's tire, which I really don't have. I'm only kidding. But I just sat there this morning. I sat out on my patio and just had some time because it was a foggy day. I love the foggy day. So I'm out on the patio. I'm just saying, Jesus, this is what I want to learn. I came back to this little quote from Sunday night that Jerry Lewis used I want to live in that space. I'm going to pass this way again. So even the last part of Romans 12 is when people are treating you unfairly and meanly, don't face evil with evil, but overcome evil with good.
See, but it's not as if that doesn't apply to the business world. It just doesn't apply to the bottom line of your balance sheet.
I'm not saying that. You lose. You have to live it unilaterally because people are not going to live it with you.
Yeah, you lose.
Yeah, that's right. That's my point.
And I mean, I think I was talking with someone else the other day, and the whole idea of living a life of sacrifice in a narcissistic world is pretty darn stupid. I'm going to yield something. I'm going to give, and everyone else, I want to take.
This is my point.
Yeah, you just go like, wow, this is like really counterculture here, and. You know, I look at what's going on in the whole economic scheme of things, and it's like the sheer stupidity of credit's the lifeblood of our economy. So I'm sitting there like,
because what I'm saying is debt is the lifeblood.
Yeah, I know. He's going like, wait a minute, this is all fantasy and make believe.
How about productivity being the basis of our economy? How about that? Actually produce something worth something.
See, I think there is the first little semblance of wisdom in this whole thing. Whenever a country stops being a manufacturing country, where it actually is producing something, the economics shift to those who do. They're actually doing something. That's where all of wealth is created. It's from the actual making, taking the raw things and making. Everyone else is a middleman on the download from what's going on. And it's like the real wealth comes from actually doing something. And to sit here and say from, you know, the chambers of government, credit is the lifeblood. It's like, you know what? Never a false, more untrue thing has been said in terms of live that reality out. You can't sustain that.
So you liked Obama's speech?
No.
You didn't.
No, I saw Jonathan sit there and it's like, he's going like, so let me get this straight. I mean, I love it when life is summarized by 11-year-old. I really do. Wait, dad is stupid and run by monkeys, okay?
Yeah, there you go. I like that.
That could have been applied to, you know, just going like, what's this whole deal? They're all clapping forever and they're just congratulating themselves. And he said, now wait a minute. For all this time, we don't really have anything and we're working hard. Then you work really hard and now we have something. And that guy wants to take it? That's what he was concluding from the speech. And he said, Dad, that's not fair. Why is life not fair? That was his conclusion. And I sat there and I said, you know what, Jonathan? I don't have an answer for that. But it doesn't change the fact that, you know what? It doesn't matter. We're still going to do the things that are right, that we're going to do. And I will believe it's going to be fine.
And how's that ostrich position working for you?
No! My head in the sand?
I think Dilbert had it right. Dilbert's comment yesterday. Dilbert, the one guy sitting there saying, well, I'm really sorry we saddled your generation with all our debts so we could have a good time. And the younger guy looks at him and says, and this is not a quote at all because I read this yesterday, but he was saying something like, don't worry, we're inventing new medicines that will keep you alive longer in a vegetative state until the poor need to come and eat you. And he's sitting, Gilbert's sitting there going, uh-oh. Because that's where I feel bad. This whole credit crunch and throwing money at everything and stimulus packages and the entire waste of money without any responsibility or accountability. I know they're throwing that out now like we're going to have that. But government has never been good at responsibility or accountability. No. That we really have mortgaged. My generation, and I'm a little older than your generation, you're half one back of me, but my generation has lived the greatest ease of any generation probably in the history of the world, in America, and the developed Western world. And yet we have done everything for, again, go back to everything, we have taken everything for our own benefit.
Yeah.
And now leave this horrible mess for our children and grandchildren to clean up. And I don't even know how you look at kids in the face. I try not to see my grandkids anymore. I'm hiding when they come. Play hide and seek and grandpa can't look you in the face, man. I mean, I just think it's so, and it's not just Obama. It started under Bush. The whole, and it's not even a Republican-Democrat issue.
No,
because
it's not.
Both of them sold out to big business to keep their political jobs. I don't think there's a person in Washington with a conscience bigger than a BB. I really don't. And I've been there. I've talked to people. I've asked people who work with those people, does anyone here have a conscience about what's right or wrong? And the answer is, no, they don't. Person cannot. Here's the answer. A conscienced person can come to Washington, but a conscienced person can't stay here. He cannot raise the money he needs to stay in office. He will lose his job.
Yeah, it seems like it is all about the government of self-interest.
It is. That's how life. That's why this world is in such chaos. That's how people live. That's how the government lives. And the problem is now is all the pigs can vote for how much food gets poured in the trough. The pigs have taken over the farmer's deal.
It's just stupid. And it's run by pigs.
It's run by pigs. Oh.
Don't. Let's get back to some other stuff.
Some wonderful forum discussion, which, as we said about the forum, don't always get a lot of that on the God Journey forum.
I don't know that that's true.
Some of it's good. Some of it goes a little whacked, but I think people don't have much else to do except post pictures and make fun of each other at the forum. But they had a pretty good one from the last one, because people really struggle with stop doing.
Yeah.
What am I? Stop doing, especially when they're going, and nothing is happening. And stop doing it. And what's happening is you're starting to boil over. And that's good. Just keep boiling over because God's touching something that needs freedom. But it got into a bit of a discussion. I was going to get your thoughts on this about fasting.
Uh-huh.
Is fasting an Old Testament thing? Is it also a New Testament thing? And some were saying, I think that's what Jesus was telling his disciples, kind of the bridegroom's here, we don't need to anymore kind of thing. I'm not there. The other thing came up, Willard and Foster, Dallas Willard and Richard Foster, have written a lot of books on spiritual disciplines. And aren't those doing things that we can do to get where we want to go?
They certainly can be. I don't think they're very effective. It's like fasting in that context is a hunger strike.
Okay. God's not real motivated by hunger strikes.
I don't think so. I really don't. I mean, I'll be honest. Fasting is something I have done a ton of. I've gone on like, you know, I just can be quiet about it. I don't need to let my left hand know my right hand.
Oh, you already told us.
But it is something.
You've lost your eternal reward now.
Yeah,
that's great.
Just flushed it. You're done. No, but the reality is I think fasting in the most, I think, fruitful context that I've understood, you really ought to add the idea of feasting, where it's like, you know what, as opposed to finding my nourishment in that stuff, food, Lord, I want you to become that source. I'm going to not focus on that. My body's going to scream, you know, wail and moan. It's going to have its, but there comes a point when you give yourself to it that it's like, Lord, I don't want to reach for comfort foods when I'm upset. I want to reach to you. I want to know you as a provision and a resource. And so for me, it's more like, God, I'm not going to demonstrate my discipline. I'm not going to demonstrate my determination. I really want to find out, if you are my source, how do I receive life from you in such a way that it actually affects the rest of me? And I've found that in a place of fasting. I really have.
Do you find yourself fasting less now that you've lived more in the grace realm than you did when you were trying to earn it more?
Yeah, but I find there is still that desire that says, Lord, this world is kind of crowding me out.
Yeah, I like the desire for fasting much better than fasting too. No, I'm kidding. I used to fast an awful lot more when I was trying to bring in revival, trying to...
Yeah, I was on the front lines of that crowd.
Get healing, trying to fix... I fasted a lot more.
Uh-huh.
I wouldn't say more fruitfully. I fasted because I was so desperate and I wanted God to do something. And fasting,
I was trying to make it happen.
And fasting was the way that somehow you built up enough hours for that to happen. Mm-hmm. I remember the first time after this whole grace-based thing. And I still fast at times because I what I'm enjoying more is I enjoy the disconnect, like you're saying, from all the world throws at you.
Yeah.
Whether it's food or media. I mean, someone talked about media fast recently. I went, oh, man, that sounds even good. That just, you know, quiet the life down. To get God to do something, like you said, hunger strike. That's the stupidest thing in the world. To withdraw from the flesh and its senses and its needs and its demands, there's a real value. I mean, I remember the first time my fast wasn't to get God to do something. I remember the first time I was fasting out of my trust in who God was. And it was a totally different fast.
Absolutely. Because it's not about deprivation. Because I think fasting, when it's just denying yourself, really ought to be called slowing. There's nothing fast about it. I mean, there really isn't. It's like, just seems like everything draws out. I got a headache. I got my tummy rumbling. And you're just going like,
your coffee,
I feel like, whatever.
Yeah, it is. Be serious. I don't get a headache when I fast.
Okay, well, God bless you.
Thank you.
The reality is, I know that for me, so much of life just gets cluttered or busy. And when you simply take out the time and just say, you know what, God, I'm going to turn to you. I want to find you. I want to acknowledge whether I live this way all the time. I am completely dependent upon you. Feed me.
Yeah.
And that, I want to say, is fruitful. Don't wear your watch. Don't watch the calendar. But it's a gaze of your soul.
I don't have to watch a calendar to know it's dinner time. I really don't. Something innate inside me that rises up and says, I got to kill a cow. I got to eat something. But I like the Willard books and the Foster books on disciplines back 25 years ago, very formative for me. We used them with a lot of folks. Again, I think Willard says this in the, I forgot what he said.
Celebration of Discipline?
That was Foster, but he did The Spirit of the Disciplines,
okay.
I think was Willard. And he said, is it as a means to manipulate God, absolutely worthless. And I think that needs to resonate. As a means to manipulate God, absolutely worthless. As an expression of a growing relationship, not the substitute for it. Not I'm trying to do all these things, hope God will move in my life. As I recognize God moving and touching me. Finding space to let that incubate, finding solitude, finding service to other people, finding expressions of that, I think are very, very helpful. But again, it's not the substitute for God not doing. It really has to come as expression of what God's already doing in life.
Yeah, and I think in all of this, the disconnect from everything that just kind of fries your circuits. Even in a religious effort to, you know, God, I want to get this breakthrough. You know, the reality is only when you stop all of your activity are you really going to have any frame of reference to see and acknowledge His in a way that you're just going, like, oh, I didn't do that.
Yeah.
I think in all of, I mean, I'm a passionate, zealous person. In all of my zeal, I got confused in terms of I'm always doing and frustrated and I can't see what God's doing. It's like the only time I've ever had real perspective is to step back and to stop all my activity, which is almost, you know, always born out of some anxiety, some worry.
Need for identity,
yeah.
You bet.
And all it's right. Like to be able to sit down requires far more courage to simply say, all right, God, I am acknowledging in real humility I can't do this.
Yeah, to confront the quiet. The fact that we keep busy and we keep stuff going because we're afraid of the quiet and what I might conclude about myself if I'm not doing something that can appear productive. And reading again Romans from the Messages, reading this Romans 10 this week, and I thought, God, this is really good. He talks about the core of my preaching, say the welcoming word to God, Jesus is my Lord. Embracing body and soul, God's work of doing in us what He did in raising Jesus from the dead. That's it. You're not doing anything. You're simply calling out to God, trusting Him to do it for you. That's salvation. With your whole being, you embrace God setting things right, and then you say it right out loud. God has set everything right between me and Him. Scripture reassures us, no one who trusts God like this, heart and soul, will ever regret it. It's exactly the same no matter what a person's religious background may be. The same God for all of us, acting the same incredibly generous way to everyone who calls out for help. Everyone who calls, help me God, gets help. I just think that's the whole. That's where it goes.
But that doesn't seem to be the invite for salvation for a lot of people. The way I've heard it often, it isn't that sense of rest that just says, hey, you know what? You've tried really hard. You've done your best. But at the end of the day, you kind of have to acknowledge, I can't get there. But here's the thing. We're going to trust in someone who has. I've not heard that altar call.
No, it's you're a lousy creep. But he died for that, so now you can be forgiven. But
if
now
you do these things.
You better get this stuff done. And that's Romans. What I just read is Romans 10, 9, and 10, the Roman road scripture about salvation. I think what a gift if we understood salvation is you can stop trying, you can stop doing all the things you're doing to earn God's approval.
Stop trying to be righteous.
And stop trying to do something to make your life have meaning and ask God to help you. And watch what he does. I just think, wow, that now if that were salvation, people would be living this journey in great freedom. But it's not the invitation to salvation. It's, yeah, he'll forgive what you've done, you stupid moron. But now you better do a whole lot better, and you better get it right, or your life's going to just be horrible.
Because the institution's lifeblood is those pew sitters.
No, that's not good. That's one of those things run by monkeys. It's got to be.
No, but I think that's the deal. It's like, it's not enough to just tell people, it's okay. It's finished. He solved it. Now, receive that.
We keep filling.
We want to make them do something.
We keep filling up that place where they feel like I have no identity. I've got to do something to validate me. So my religion now validates me. And that just fits fine with what most institutions need. Now, I'm getting some great email lately from pastors who listen to this podcast and saying it's revamping their whole sense of fellowship. I'm going to Knoxville, Tennessee this weekend to be with a Southern Baptist bunch of people who've decided not to replace the last pastor that left. They want to be a truly faith community based in grace. They don't have a clue how to do it. Paul Young was with them last spring or summer and called me from there saying, Wayne, these people could really benefit. You can spend some time with them. So I'm going to go out to be with them. I have no idea what. I love the journey they're on because they're saying we're willing to risk everything. We want to be a family. We want to share the. So I know when we talk about places run by monkeys, there's lots of people demonkeying the place and learning to live in grace. And I think that's lovely. But for those of you who just want to be couch potatoes, there's this. Flip over to Romans 12 in the message, and here's the first part. And this is that, you know, present yourselves as a living sacrifice to God. Again, from a performance context, they're going to busy you all. Now you're a living sacrifice. You got to. Here's what it says. So here's what I want you to do. So here's the do. People are going, what do I do? Here's Paul through Eugene Peterson saying, here's what I want you to do. God helping you. Take your everyday, ordinary life. You're sleeping, you're eating, you're going to work, and you're walking around life. And place it before God as an offering. Embrace what God does for you is the best thing you can do for Him. Don't become so well adjusted to your culture that you fit into it without even thinking. Instead, fix your attention on God. You'll be changed from the inside out, readily recognize what He wants from you and quickly respond to it. And that's not what He wants from me, the list of do's. Right. That is what He's asking of me today and serving that person, loving that, forgiving, being nice to my wife, whatever. Unlike the culture around you, always dragging you down to its level of immaturity, God brings the best out of you, develops well-formed maturity in you. Now,
see,
that's a good do.
Absolutely.
If you need a do, that's a do.
But that's where I think it's, is it out of Philippians where it says, you know, God is at work in you both to will and to do? That's where it's like, you know what, when you're actually spending some time and saying, all right, hey, God, my gaze is upon you. That's what I find transacts. I'm no longer trying, but something's changing. And I find the things that come out of me really fall in that category. I don't know how you did this. I don't know where it came from. But somehow I now have the will to do something I didn't have the want to before.
Yeah.
And that's where I go, like, gosh, Lord, however you do that thing you do, please conquer more ground in my soul because I love the fruit of that. It isn't religious trying, and on the backside, I'm not looking for my little religious reward either. It's you're changing my nature, my heart.
But I dare say most people steeped in religion are not going to see they're eating, they're sleeping, they're going to work, they're walking around life as imbued with God's reality in life. I think people who
you think
making the bed, doing dishes, going to their job, mowing lawns or, you know, writing mortgages or whatever they do, I don't think this is their walking around in life with God. No, it's not. It's, I'm going to do the stupid thing, and hopefully, you know, I can write the Christian song that changes the world, or write that, or, you know, then do something really significant for God somewhere else. And I love the whole present yourself living sacrifice. It's your real life. It's making beds.
Daily life. It's every breath you take.
What you do, who you're passing, what does God have in this for me? And instead of living in the anxiety of my frustrated identity, I get to live in the joy of, this is what God's put me for me right now. He may want to move me to a different space, but that's His doing. I just call out, God, would you help me today? God, would you show me your way? God, would you teach me to live loved? And then see that as happening, not in a seminar somewhere, not I've got to go to a Bible study somewhere. That happens in life. That happens brushing your teeth, taking a shower, driving to work. That's where that stuff happens. It's not divorce. It's not the stuff you got to do, hopefully, to find some God moment somewhere else in your life. Those are the moments God wants to imbue with life. And I think when I was a religionist, I missed all that. I was frustrated in those mundane things because they were taking away from my real calling, which was which my real calling at that time was arrogance. I didn't say it that way. I look back now, that was my calling. My calling is I had to
Confessions of a religionist.
Oh, it was
my
sad.
Real calling was arrogance.
Oh man. That was my calling, not God's, but for sure.
Well, no, I think that whole religion feeds that sense of I need to achieve. I need to do something so that I can finally feel secure in this righteous environment. As opposed to, it's like, you know what? I mean, it was funny. There was one time I was standing in front of the refrigerator. And I was looking for something. And I didn't
think. You weren't fasting, were you?
No, I wasn't. I stand in front of the refrigerator. You know when you just sort of like tractor being there, it's like I'm not really hungry, but I just, it's like I want something, and it's like, you know, I know I'm the only guy that ever, you know,
I don't do
that.
I really don't do
okay,
that.
Okay, great.
But I know people do.
But yeah, I'm one of those people that did.
I hear you.
And I'm there, and clear as a bell, and it's just, Brad, what you're really hungry for isn't in there. And I'm going like, okay.
Yeah, but what is in there is what will not make me hungry for the thing I'm hungry for anymore.
No, and the first thought was, you're right. I'm not seeing anything in here that I want.
I must go out. I must order out.
But my conclusion was, well, where is it, you know?
Yeah.
And so I felt like some people think this is kind of bizarre, crazy. But the reality is, he said, Brad, what you're really hungry for is righteousness. And I'm going like, no. Because at the moment, I was not having a spiritual moment. I'm going like, God, you're sort of intruding. I'm looking for a snack. And he's saying, oh, what you're really hungry for is righteousness. And I sat there going like, no, that's not it. And then, Lord, really? That's what I want? And I said, well, what's righteousness? And he said, standing right in front of me. And that's when it dawned on me. It's like, to me, it's more an issue of geography than performance. If righteousness is my capacity where I'm not frightened, I'm not uncomfortable, but I can be right in front of you, gosh, Lord, the truth is, yeah, I am hungry for that. This in the refrigerator, it will never produce that.
Yeah.
But well, the idea that that's God's longing to be with us, that was an invasion of my little snack moment where God kind of said, hey, the real hunger that deeply satisfies, it's me. It's like, gosh, to be able to connect with that.
That's the woman at the well thing. You know, bedding down five guys, now it's sixth one, not even married. And Jesus is saying to her, you don't know what you're thirsty for. You think it's for the right man to fill your life or the right job or the right house or the right whatever it is that we think will finally make our lives full. And he's just saying, I've got water to drink that you know not of. And if you drink it, you'll never be thirsty again. And she's still thinking, oh, gosh, I'd never have to come to this well again. And he really is saying, there's something that you really desire. And I think for all of us, what that is it's to be like him in the world. It's to know God as Father and to live in the glory and freedom. I think every heart hungers for that. But not knowing that's what it is, we fill up that space with all the other things
that we do. Our lives with a thousand things.
What we eat, what we drink, where we go, the friends we have sometimes are to medicate all that. And I think that's why the whole stop doing thing is so scary to people, because it's masking so much.
Yeah, you do come in touch with the knock on the door of your soul when you kind of just stop.
Yeah, and then you're not getting any points for anything. And all the things you did to, you know, fulfill yourself are now unmasked for what they are, that they really didn't lead to something rich and deep in who he is. And Jesus is still saying, it's that I've got food to eat that you know not of. I've got water to drink. This is the space that I think God has invited us to live in, where out of our beings, the spring of living water wells up for other people even, not just ourselves. And but I think you've got to realize that that's what we're hungering for is not what we think it is. It's not the things we're out there trying to get, a better job, a better house, a bigger ministry, a more popular book, you know, whatever it is, you know, the song that wins American Idol. Whatever. It's none of that is going to fulfill what's broken in us. Only he does. And when he does, then there's wonderful things that spill out of our lives, even gifts God's given us, things he's equipped us to do, things that we enjoy doing with him. It's not like those things become insignificant or immaterial, but they're differently lived when they're expressing a life I already know is very different than trying to earn a life I don't have.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is a true statement. I enjoy most the things that I know he has given to me, as opposed to something that I got. You know, I, because when I know that it's like, you know what, this is not the fruit of my effort. This is not the fruit of my achievement. This is not my proud little labor. But this is a gift that reflects he loves me in the secure foundation of not because, and I've got to fill in the validation mark.
Yeah.
He loves me because, but he just loves me. Those are the things that, you know, when I cherish something, it's a sense of going like, gosh, that's the expression that, wow, does that ever do something inside my soul? You did this because you loved me.
That's the flip side. What you just said, I think, is the flip side of people who don't have and feel this angst to get.
Uh-huh.
And the people who have, who feel like, I deserve this, I've earned it, who stop living in what they have as God's gift.
Oh, God, that's a terrible place.
And it is, and it changes everything about the relationships you want to have with people, because now you have the right to what you have earned or done or accomplished.
And there's no graciousness in
that. And I've been there. I've been there in my own life where you think, oh, man, I must have really earned it. God's given me. And it takes your head into some really sick space.
Yeah.
And it makes you arrogant. And it distances you, and you end up isolated. Both of them, you end up isolated and alone. And I think this whole space of living in the gifts of God, living in what God gives today, not what Wayne earns or Wayne can earn or Wayne even has earned in the past, but just know whatever I have. And you know, John the Baptist gets there. There's so much in Scripture that everything we have is a gift. I didn't earn it. It's a gift from his hand. I'm not worth something more because I have this gift and you don't have that gift. And, you know, I know lots of frustrated writers who are trying to get people to read their stuff. And I know they look at me going, well, everybody's people reading your stuff. And I know, but I think it's a gift. I don't know. I know I frustrated for 20 years trying to earn that space. It didn't work. And it just left me frustrated and angry every day. And the space of just saying, gosh, whatever we have is a gift from God. Live in that gift. And then see where else God leads your life. And that's part of that whole stop doing life. But I understand why that scares people. I probably spent a good 20 years of my adult life running. Busyness, labor, effort, work. So I hear people going, you know, it's really stop doing things really tough. How long have you been doing it? Oh, yeah, like a week. And I hate to depress people out there going, it's going to take me 20 years. Hopefully not. But it is a lifelong process of learning to live inside the giftedness of God and calling out for help and then living in the reality of life as it unfolds, which is wonderful stuff.
Thank you for traveling with us on the God Journey. You can be part of the conversation by visiting our website, thegodjourney.com.